welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 14th of November 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, so we are here to cast a critical eye over the week's news of interest to nationalists, all the things that have happened or are going to happen that we think British nationalists might be interested in. And who better to do that with today than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How is life treating you?
Yeah, life is treating me okay, actually. Yes, I've been puzzling, I suppose, over the course of the last week or so as to quite what magic trick the Chancellor of the Exchequer is going to pull out of his hat in order to make ends meet as far as the nation's budget is concerned. Because it looks as though they, both he and Rishi Sunak, have got their work cut out in that respect.
Isn't it Jeremy Hunt? He's our new Chancellor of the Exchequer, isn't he?
That's right. Both he and Rishi Sunak, and also Kwasi Kwarteng, have all committed themselves to eventually arriving at a low tax, high growth kind of economy. By high growth, I think they're just thinking there purely of gross domestic product, not thinking of gross domestic product per person. I think they're really going to have their work cut out because of the fact that the country is in such a mess, and the mess that effectively started with the pandemic and with the decision to pay people to work from home and to not go into work and to claim furlough, which then meant that there was lots of money coming into the economy, but not the commensurate amount of goods and services being generated because people weren't working. And so therefore, what the government should have done is that they should have quarantined people who were sick rather than quarantining all the people that are healthy. And so they've created massive costs for themselves. And I can remember writing several articles on the Western Spring website at the time, pointing out the fact that it was going to cost the country a massive amount of money, that this money would be very inflationary if it came from government expenditure. I estimated, I think the costs were going to be something like $300 billion in total for all the measures that they were putting in place. And then no sooner had we got through the pandemic and that the need to spend all that money had ended than we've then had the war with Ukraine, which has meant that oil and gas prices have shot up and the government have now committed themselves to helping people out with regard to subsidies to and the cap on the price of energy. And that, again, has created a massive cost. We've got the ongoing and spiraling cost of illegal immigration into this country. We've got so many professions now have gone several years now without having a pay rise that matches the cost of living or the rise in the cost of living. And so there are lots of workers in all sorts of vital areas who are very disgruntled about the fact that they are suffering drops in their income in real terms. I noticed the nurses the other day, the nursing unions, I think they're asking for 5% plus the rate of inflation. So the rate of inflation being at something like 13%, 5 on top of that gives you 18%. So they're looking for almost a 20% pay rise, which from a government that's trying to save money. So this is a perfect storm, isn't it?
Yeah, everybody's in this situation, really, aren't they? I mean, you got the Royal Mail, they're striking. You got the nurses that are striking now. You got British Rail. They're striking, and it's all down to Rishi Sunak, who is now our Prime Minister. I mean, he was the Chancellor of the Exchequer that decided to pay out all this money in furlough and eat out to stop out or whatever it was. You were getting two meals for the price of one and just giving everybody all this money while they stayed at home. And I think that's really why people didn't want him as the Prime Minister. But now he's the Prime Minister as well. And he's got Jeremy Hunt there helping him. Jeremy Hunt, another politician who really isn't very popular. I mean, how did he get into that position? How did he know what to do with the economy just to reverse all the changes that Kwasi Kwarteng had made? I mean, what knowledge does he have of the economy? Surely it's the people that were pulling his strings that were telling him what to do. Who is it that's doing that? I mean, he's just a mouthpiece for these hidden forces that are really sort of controlling these things. And then you got Matt Hancock as well, who was responsible for keeping everybody at home and preventing people from being able to see their nearest and dearest when they were in hospital, stopping people from seeing their senile relatives that really did need to see their family in order to keep themselves happy and keep themselves as sane as possible. All of that was stopped by by Matt Hancock. And then he was caught having an affair, wasn't he? He was breaking his own rules. He told everybody they had to be 6 meters apart, I think it was. Not 2 meters apart, something ridiculous like that. And then we see on the closed circuit television cameras that he's snogging someone who is not his wife. And then he fell from grace, and people are not very happy with him. And now suddenly he appears on television again in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. He's being paid $500,000. So we got Rishi Sunak, who gave all this money out. He's now Prime Minister. We got Matt Hancock that prevented everybody from seeing their relatives, also presided over all these elderly people that were sent back to care homes and caught COVID, died. And now he's on our television screens as this big, big celebrity. And of course, his constituents aren't very happy because instead of working for them, he's out there in Australia, sunning himself in the sun. I don't tend to watch very much television, but I believe you've had a look at this I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, Max. What do you think of Matt Hancock being on there?
Well, I think it's like a sort of a modern day version of Trial by Ordeal. So Matt Hancock was blamed by lots of people because they couldn't go and sit with their relatives when they were dying, which is obviously tragic and everything, and I don't wish to make light of that, but Matt Hancock has stated on this program that he's gone on the program because he wants to have a measure of forgiveness from the public. But it seems like the public want to put him through every single of these ghastly trials that they put people through. And I did hear one of the TV news reporters mention that there's been a massive uptake in the I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here app for their phones, so that they can all continually vote for Matt Hancock to have to go through these to do these challenges instead of the other people that are in the jungle with him. And so it looks as if he's going to spend the 2 weeks or whatever it is that they spend over doing this, 3 weeks perhaps, every day having to undergo one ghastly trial after another. And it's quite funny from that point of view. The other aspect of it that I think is quite interesting is that Matt Hancock is absolutely doing his damnedest to come over as a really nice guy. You know, he's interested in people. He's willing to do work, etc. He's willing to sacrifice in order to get food for the other people that are in the jungle with him. And last night he was doing one of these Bush Tucker trials together with Boy George. And Matt Hancock kind of remained reasonably good humoured throughout the whole thing. He did gag a few times with some of the revolting things that he was required to eat, but he managed to remain sort of good humoured throughout the whole thing. Boy George had a much harder time. He did far more gagging and gurgling and making all sorts of strange noises whilst he was, but again, still managed to eat his fair share of these things. And so, I think that from the point of view of punishing Matt Hancock, I think that that those people who are continually voting for him to have to undergo all these ordeals have had a certain amount of fun out of him. But I think that he seems to be rising above it. And I think if he carries on the way he is, he's going to come out of there smelling of roses, and because people will gradually think, crikey, how much more horrific stuff can this poor guy, you know, take? And, you know, what beasts the people must be that are continually voting to sort of keep him doing this when all the other celebrities are all sitting around pretty much doing nothing. So I think it's interesting and quite sort of quite a humorous event, actually.
So
going back to what you're saying, though, about Rishi Sunak becoming the Prime Minister, I think that other politicians and senior members of the Conservative Party kind of realised that taking over, becoming the leader of the Conservative Party this year was going to be a poison chalice. For all the reasons we've already mentioned about all of the various problems that they're facing. And Rishi Sunak was the one that wanted to be the Prime Minister the most. Boris Johnson came back from America when Liz Truss resigned. And initially he wanted to stand against Rishi Sunak. And he, by all accounts, managed to get enough votes so that he could have forced a second round where there would have been a runoff where the Conservative Party members would have voted. And it was predicted that Boris Johnson would get more votes than Rishi Sunak. And so Boris Johnson could have had the premiership, but decided it wasn't the right time. And I think because he knew it was a poison chalice. And no matter what happens, we're going to be going through a very difficult economic time. And whoever is the Prime Minister is going to have to make some very unpopular decisions, and they will pay for it in the long run. And I think that it's highly likely the Conservatives are going to lose the next general election. And when they do, then there'll be a change of leadership at the top. And it wouldn't surprise me if Boris Johnson comes back to claim the premiership at that point, with Rishi Sunak having taken all of the flak and the opprobrium is coming his way.
Yeah, it does seem as if a lot of former Conservative voters are now supporting the Reform Party. If you look at the polls, Labour are still doing well. I think one of the reasons why people are upset with Rishi Sunak, as you're pointing out, you know, we're about to enter a time where people have got less and less money because of what he gave away during furlough and the inflation that has been caused by all of that. But we had him going to this COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt this week as well, the Climate Action Conference. He did say that he wasn't going, and then he changed his mind and he did go. And what did he do when he was there? Well, he promised billions of pounds to Africa and India as part of climate reparations, as if it wasn't enough that we went over there and brought them civilization and brought them roads and technology and universities and taught them how to read and write and how to run a democracy and gave them all the things that we had in the civilization. That's not good enough. Apparently we need to be punished for that. We need to be paying reparations for that. So while they're talking about people on benefits may not have their benefits increased in line with inflation, people with pensions may not have their pensions increased in line with inflation, but all these countries over the other side of the world are going to be given reparations, and we're all going to have to pay for it. And who is it that did this? Well, it's Rishi Sunak. We also have India, who is looking forward to having visa-free travel to Britain as part of a trade deal, which they seem to think that they're going to get now that Rishi Sunak is Prime Minister. So there's all those reasons as well as to why people may not be voting for the Conservatives in the future. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, well, I wholeheartedly agree with the things you've been saying, actually, that I mean, certainly the issue with reparations, it's just a matter of, you know, when is all this going to end? When are white people effectively going to get up off their knees and say, we're no longer going to be paying for all of this? You know, it's about time we did. You know, we're expected to pay reparations to people who became slaves because they weren't allowed to live in Africa. And now we have to pay reparations to the people who do live in Africa because We didn't take them out of Africa, or we didn't give them, we didn't provide them with greater wealth. It seems that no matter what we do, there is always some way in which the table gets turned round so that we end up having to pay, and people from the third world get the benefit.
One positive thing that does seem to be happening, I think that online harms bill that we talked about in the last episode, that's definitely been kicked into the long grass now. Hopefully it will end up just fizzling out entirely. I mean, it's a good motive to protect children. You don't want children seeing pornography, but they're being taught all this stuff in schools now. And this online harms bill was basically just a way to prevent people from making criticisms of government policy that touched on immigration or touched on sex education or transgenders and all that sort of thing. So that's good that that's been removed. But on the other side, we have this police crime and sentencing bill, I think it's called, or something like that. And what it basically means is that it's giving the police extra powers to stop protests. And I think this ties in with these Just Stop Oil protests, which we've seen people going into museums and throwing paint over them. Last week we saw somebody throwing eggs at King Charles, and we've seen them putting a stop to the movement on the roads, on motorways, so people can't get into work. We actually saw two lorries crash last week, and a police officer was injured because of these protests. We've seen them gluing them hands to the roads, and we've seen images of the police that are going to them saying, "Would you like a drink? Would you like some water? Can we get anything for you?" Whereas in France, they've literally been ripping them up off the road, throwing them off the road so that people can continue getting to work. Over here in Britain, they've been doing the complete opposite to that. It's been a very, very softly approach. And I think a lot of this is so that this is being deliberately done. The police are treating them with kid gloves so that the public says, come on, we do something, do something. Yes, we do support the police having greater powers to put a stop to protests. And once that is in place, then the police would be able to use those powers to put a stop to any protests that were not politically correct. They could say that, oh, it's a threat to public safety because Antifa might come out. And if Antifa come out, there might be violence. Therefore, we're not going to allow you to protest immigration, or we're not going to allow you to protest drag queen story hour because there could be a danger to public safety. So they could end up using these new powers against nationalists, and they would get support for bringing these powers in because the public are so infuriated by these Just Stop Oil protests. And I did hear that Just Stop Oil have said that they're no longer going to be protesting on the motorway. But just this softly approach that we've seen so far, it seems to get used all the time with Extinction Rebellion. And Extinction Rebellion and their antics are being used as the reason why we need to beef up the police powers to deal with protests. Yet I think it's going to end up being used on all sorts of other issues. And that's the reason why Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion, that's why they're being treated with kid gloves. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, I think certainly when there have been demonstrations by nationalist organisations in the past, those nationalist organisations have then been kettled by the police. And kettling, for those who don't know what the term means, is where the police herd the demonstrators into some back street somewhere or to some back street car park where they can't be seen by the public. And they are then kept there for several hours until everybody is absolutely busting for the toilet before they then let them go. And by that time, everybody needs to sort of rush off and find the closest public toilets and go and get something to eat, etc. And the demonstration is made as unpleasant as can possibly be by the police. And so there is a massive difference in terms of the way in which the police are applying kid gloves to these Just Stop Oil protesters. I think that there isn't any need for additional legislation. All the legislation that's required is in place. People who glue themselves to works of art are committing vandalism and should be prosecuted for being common vandals. The As far as the people who climb onto the gantries are concerned, I really can't see why that has to stop the flow of the traffic, because the people will climb onto the gantries, and if they're intent on staying there for a long time, they don't want to fall asleep while they're up there. And so what you'll find is that they'll all be chaining themselves to the actual gantry so they can't actually fall off. So they're not going to be falling off and landing on the cars coming underneath. And if they deliberately drop stuff on the cars coming underneath, well, there are already laws against that sort of thing, and those people can be prosecuted in that way. If the police wanted to make it unpleasant for people to take part in these protests on the gantries over motorways, there are all sorts of ways in which they could do it. I remember chuckling when I saw there was a report perhaps 2 or 3 weeks back of some of these protesters that broke into a Volkswagen factory somewhere in Germany and who then superglued themselves to the floor in order to halt manufacture. And the factory manager just turned all the heating off, turned the lights off, and told everybody to go home and come back the following day. And they just left them sitting in this freezing cold factory, glued to the floor overnight, and they were all pretty well very grateful when somebody came in the morning to free them and they didn't hang around after that. And so the same sort of approach can be used by the police. I don't see why the police can't use things like paintball guns to just shoot the protesters to get them down. That they are causing a nuisance. There must be some measure the police can take. I'm not saying that there must be a measure the police can take, and I don't know what it is. What I'm saying is, if somebody is so obviously breaking the law and causing a public nuisance in the way that these people are, there has to be a measure that the police can take in order to get them down. And where the police employ a degree of force in order to get the people down, that degree of force has got to be seen as being reasonable, as long as it isn't excessive. And I think that doing things to make the people up there uncomfortable is the way to go.
Well, they keep doing the opposite, don't they? You know, you say you should make them uncomfortable up there. They're trying to make them as comfortable as possible, like asking them if they want water, and you know, would they like a little drink and all the rest of it? Would they like some food? Would they like some sandwiches to be brought to them? You know, it's the complete opposite of the way that it should be dealt with. And I think that is because they want to bring in these extra powers for them. As you say, Max, they've already got enough powers to deal with protests. We did have a little bit of good news last week. Suella Braverman went to the police conference. Home Secretary Suella Braverman today told police chiefs to ensure their officers are focused on common sense policing and not debating gender on Twitter. In a forthright speech to a police chiefs conference in London, Mrs. Braverman took a swipe at politically correct distractions as she urged a back to basics approach. So that's good news. She's given them instruction there that it's not so important that they mess around on Twitter. They should be doing proper policing. And I have to say that there's a very good Twitter account that draws attention to this common sense policing. I think it might be called, I'll put a link in the article. It's the guy Harry Miles, or Harry Mills, I think his name is. He's an ex police officer, and he's the one that took the police to court for non-crime hate incidents and won his appeal. And the police were then given instruction that they have to actually prove that somebody is acting with hostility, not just take somebody else's word for it, in order to record these non-crime hate incidents. If there isn't a crime there, then they shouldn't be recording it, basically. But he's been drawing attention to all these woke agendas of the police, and he's doing a very, very good job of it. Some of his retweets have resulted in Suella Braverman taking the police to task about it, and the police have actually removed these tweets. But he's pointing out the fact that the police should not be supporting gender ideology. They should not be supporting this LGBTQ stuff, because it's all political and the police are supposed to be non-political. So it's very good that Suella Braverman is backing them up on this, saying the police should not be debating gender on Twitter. And she's also said that the police are no longer going to need to have a degree in order to get into the police. And I guess, again, that's a way of preventing people with these woke agendas that have been brainwashed at university getting in. But it might result, it might mean that you've got more people that aren't that intelligent that are getting in. So, I mean, I'm in two minds over this. But when I mentioned this to you before we went on the show, Max, you said that this was definitely a good thing, that the police no longer have to have a degree to get into the police. So what's your reasoning on that?
Well, it used to be, if we went back to, say, the 1970s, 1980s, then if you joined the police, then no matter what qualifications you had, no matter what privileged background you came from, once you had finished at Hendon, if you were joining the Metropolitan Police, you then had to do 2 years. I think they called you a probationer during that 2 year period. You had to do 2 years on the beat, effectively, which then ensured that every single person who becomes a police officer has to have a grounding in walking the beat and identifying crime at street level and dealing with criminals and dealing with violent drunks and things of this sort, so that every police officer that then progresses on to the higher ranks will have had experience of what the police officers on the front line have to put up with. And that was the good thing about that. But in the period between the sort of 80s and now, they've done away with the requirement. And I can remember some years back, there was a measure passed that then meant that people could be recruited straight from university into a more senior police role, where they were effectively an officer in command of other police officers. And so now anybody who's gone through university and got a degree can opt for the fast track, where they miss out the two years as a probationer. And it then means that we've got police officers who have never, people who are in senior positions within the police, who have never ever walked the beat, who don't know what it's like to face danger, who don't know what it's like to have to try and arrest somebody when you are alone in the street and there's nobody else there to protect you. And this is why we're getting senior police officers who are, in my view, unsuitable for the job, because you have to have some knowledge of what it's like to at the sharp end in order to be able to command other people in the field. And it, you know, the same goes for the army as well. I think that people who join the army as officers should undertake the same kind of basic training that the ordinary recruits do, and should have the same preparedness to perform under fire in the same way that the other ranks do, so that they understand what it is they're asking their men to do. And so I think that doing away with the requirement for police officers to have a degree will mean that there will be some more places available. I wouldn't imagine necessarily it's going to make a massive difference, but it obviously will make some difference, so that people who are less academic but more practical will have an opportunity to pursue a career in the police.
So it means people will actually get proper training then. They'll need to have experience before they actually get to ordering the other police around. So, yeah, that does make a lot of sense. Suella Braveman does seem to be doing quite well, I think, actually, as Home Secretary. She's also come up with an idea that you actually came up with a couple of years back, Max. And I think I recall this idea. You brought this up at the start of COVID, when the cruise ships were not allowed to operate because of COVID. And your suggestion was, with the problems that we have with the illegal immigration, why don't they just put them on these cruise ships and store them on these cruise ships? And then even when the cruise ship was full, the cruise ship could just steam off back to Africa, and they could get their asylum somewhere like Rwanda, where the government has this deal to put illegal asylum seekers and economic migrants and send them to Rwanda. So your idea was, why don't we make use of these cruise ships and put them on these cruise ships? Well, this week I saw A headline on GB News telling us migrants crossing the channel could be returning to sea after reports suggest the Home Office are considering using disused cruise ships to house asylum seekers. So once again, we came up with these suggestions years ago, and then the government finally come up with them. But they're not just saying that they wanted to put them on disused cruise ships. They're also now talking about university halls and holiday parks to ease the pressure on hotels. So they're going to be putting them up in Pontins holiday camps. Somehow, I think, rather than actually putting them on these cruise ships, they will probably end up putting them in the holiday camps. But then, you know, where are people going to go when they want to go on holiday? People are already having problems with booking out hotels to stay in. We've had people having their weddings cancelled because the hotel they booked the wedding for is now filled up with illegal immigrants. They're now using five-star hotels. They've gone from three-star to four-star to five-star. Now they're talking about holiday camps as well. I doubt very much whether they will actually use these cruise ships, but I mean, it is a sensible idea. But university halls as well. I mean, where are they going to put the students? What are your thoughts on this, Max?
Well, there aren't enough halls of residence going around or available for students who want to go to university even now. And what it will mean is that large numbers of students will be forced to take up renting accommodation in their university town, where they'll have private landlords and where they'll have to pay higher rents than they would have to in the halls of residence. So, you know, that's a bad move as far as students are concerned. And I hope that if that measure is brought in, that the students' union, the NUS, do decide that providing for asylum seekers in this way, if I use the term asylum seeker, that most of them aren't asylum seekers, most of them are economic migrants, allowing economic migrants to take accommodation, the low cost accommodation that ought to be available for students, and pushing students into the private rental market is a bad thing for British students, basically. I hope that they do realise that. I was watching a TV program during the course of the last week where they were dealing with this issue of migration, and they were mentioning the fact that something like more than 1% of the male population of Albania now lives in the UK. The reporter went around various rural parts of Albania, and what they found was that there are large areas of Albania that are just now uninhabited. Where there are lots and lots of houses, entire villages in some cases, that are just empty, where the people that otherwise would have lived in those villages have come to the UK. And the reporter that produced this programme went into a school and was asking students in the school what they wanted to do with their life once they left school. And almost 100% of them are saying that they want to come and live in England. And so I think that this flow of migrants from Albania to England is going to continue unabated until a government decides to get a lot tougher with the migrants and stopping them from coming over. It's just ridiculous that we have a situation where there's a country like Albania that's just empty, and that the Albanians are coming to the UK and are then becoming a drain on our social services system, because they when they arrive, having come across the channel in small boats, they are in need of accommodation, they're in need of spending money, they get given legal aid, etc. What's wrong with these people developing this land that is just empty and available for them to develop? You know, if I was a young Albanian man having come out of school in Albania, and there were whole villages standing empty, then the cost of buying those houses would be very, very cheap indeed. And a similar kind of blight affects Italy, where there are lots of villages in Italy that are standing empty, not because the Italians are migrating and going to other places around the world in large numbers in the same way that the Albanians are, but because the birth rate in Italy has dropped so far below replacement level now that it's beginning to create whole villages where nobody lives there any longer because the people have died out. And the point is that a lot of the municipal leaders in Italy have set up schemes where you can actually buy a house in Italy for €1. You have to, within a space of 2 years, bring that house up to a modern day fit for human accommodation standard, and so you will need to spend more on the property than just €1. But the fact of the matter is that such is the sort of disparity of circumstances that's being created around Europe as a result of migration, as a result of the pressures on our young people to defer and constantly defer starting a family, so that the reproduction rates the whole of Europe are below replacement level. And this is all part of, I used the term a perfect storm earlier on. This is a perfect storm that's got so many facets to it. It's just almost unbelievable. And that the solution to all of these problems is just for the people to vote nationalist and to get a nationalist government where the priority of the government is to look after its own people first. That's the most important prerequisite. We've got to have governments where the government has got its first loyalty to and its first concern for the indigenous British people, and to use whatever measures are necessary in order to protect the current interests and the future interests of the British people. And people have that are activists within the Just Stop Oil protests and the people that are eco warriors and all this sort of thing have thrown up their hands in horror at the fact that the government have started to issue more licenses for the for drilling for oil and gas in the North Sea. But the point is that if the government doesn't do that, then we're going to face horrendous problems with the price of oil, because I rather suspect that even once the war in Ukraine is finished, that the cost of oil and gas is going to remain exceedingly high, and we as a country need to practice autarky. We need to become self-sufficient, and self-sufficient in terms of energy production. And one way of becoming self-sufficient as quickly as possible would be for us to start to develop the gas and the oil in the North Sea.
I'm surprised they haven't just got these empty villages, but I'm surprised they haven't also got palaces that are being built by people with the money that's actually being sent back by these Albanians that are here in Britain. And I did also see one of these migrants that's been staying in these hotels, and he was complaining. He said, "I've been staying in this hotel for a year now. When am I going to get given a house?" And you just think, that's incredible, isn't it? The government is paying out £150 a night for this fake asylum seeker to stay in a 4 or 5 star hotel, and he's complaining that he hasn't been given a house yet. And that's what happens when they finish in these hotels. They get given social housing. They either get the rent paid for them in the private market, or they actually get given a council house. And we've got I don't know, million British citizens here that are waiting to be housed. And instead of that, you've got people being put up in hotels and then being sent on to public housing. Yeah, it's an absolute disgrace. Well, shall we get into our eugenics presentation, Max, do you think?
Yes, let's continue with that. That's pretty good.
Let's continue talking about Britain's contribution to eugenics. And we're talking today about the Eugenics Society again. The Eugenics Society's records show an overriding concern to prevent those people who were deemed feeble-minded, degenerate or mentally defective, not just from overbreeding, but from reproducing at all. Such disparaging terms for people with chromosomal disorders and learning disabilities were then used routinely by scientists, health professionals, educators, and social workers who grouped them with other problem people. Well, I would like to know, what other terminology would they like them to use? I mean, what have you got there? Feeble-minded, degenerate, or mentally defective? I mean, what do we use today? Neurodivergent, which means to diverge from the neurological norm. We would say that, I guess, instead of feeble-minded or mentally defective, we would say neurodivergent. Degenerate, I mean, that means declined in function. I mean, what other term can you actually use? Mentally defective, I guess you could say neurologically challenged. I mean, what is this issue here with the terminology that's actually used? I mean, it doesn't actually change the problem, does it? The terminology that we use. I mean, what they're basically saying here is these disparaging terms we use routinely by scientists. Well, you know, if you've got people with chromosomal disorders, that's not a good thing, is it? You know, you're not going to be able to talk about it in glowing terms, because it means they've actually got a disorder. And why would you want people with disorders to reproduce other people with disorders? If you were to talk to those people that have been born with a chromosomal disorder and say, would you rather have been born without a chromosomal disorder? Of course, they're going to say yes. And that is the mentality behind saying, well, it's not a good idea for people with chromosomal disorders to reproduce at all, because you don't want people to be born with those disorders. It just seems common sense to me. I guess the way they're looking at it is, well, it must be difficult for these people that have these disorders, if they've been prevented from reproducing, they can't reproduce somebody that looks like them. But surely the people that we should be most concerned about is the next generation. You know, people that are going to be born. They should have a right to be born into a healthy body and a healthy mind. And that's what human rights should be, the right to be born into a healthy body with a healthy mind. And the way that you do that is to control, basically, the breeding of people that don't have healthy bodies and don't have healthy minds. Another way to look at it is, who are they to think that they have the right to take away somebody's healthy body and healthy mind and create them in a body without a healthy body and without a healthy mind? I mean, that would be another way to look at it, wouldn't it? To say, who are you to have the right to take away what everybody else is born with in your offspring? You know, perhaps. What do you think of this, Max?
I think in some respects, this is born out of a desire on the part of governments to have as large a proportion of the population dependent upon the government as possible. What governments tend not to like is people who are independently minded and independent of action. And a way of making more and more people dependent upon the government is to increase the number of people who have birth defects. Any measure which is discussed with the intention of introducing it so that it will reduce the number of birth defects that occur is attacked. And where it can't be attacked for scientific reasons, it's attacked because it's upsetting for the people that have the defect to be spoken about in those terms. And they constantly are inventing new politically correct or woke terms to replace the terms that already exist. And then once they've got everything described in a politically correct and woke terminology, they then decide that actually that even that terminology isn't sufficiently politically correct and sufficiently woke. And they invent some more terminology and regard it as shocking and horrible and vile for you to continue to use the old, what was the old politically correct and woke terminology, and so that it effectively undermines the ability of anybody with common sense views to actually say, actually, we should be doing something about this in terms of encouraging those people with the good with good inherited characteristics to have more children, instead of allowing people to be able to say these things that whenever they mention anybody who has an unwanted inherited characteristic or an unhelpful invented characteristic, whatever you want to call it, then the people that are saying these things can then be attacked and then be cancelled and shunned and vilified for having raised the subject in such an unfortunate and a coarse way. And of course, there's like a whole industry of people who just exist to invent spurious conditions that are that are claimed to be inherited conditions that can't be cured, and this then creates this this requirement then for them to have a lifelong medication, which means that they for the whole of their lives then become dependent upon the government and therefore more obedient in the way that the governments seem to want nowadays.
Yeah, back then you could call a spade a spade. I mean, you could say if somebody's mentally defective, they're defective. They're not functioning in the way that everybody else is functioning. They're not functioning to the greatest ability of man. I mean, I just think they should really come out with a right of a child to be born into a healthy body with a healthy mind. I mean, and that would be a wonderful thing to do. But of course, they don't want to do that. They'll word it in a different way, won't they? They would say that that was infringing on people's right to reproduce if you were to do that. And back then, they had all these debates about this as well. It says here, although members usually agreed on the main principles of eugenics, throughout its long history, there were differences, especially in its practical application, whether through positive eugenics or negative eugenics. And we've talked about this before, haven't we, Max, about these different ways of doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's perfectly possible to devise a form of wording which isn't insulting to people who have a specific inherited condition, and whereby the solutions and ways of easing that can be discussed, but also so that the application of eugenic principles can make it less likely that anybody in a future generation will have a similar defect. It is eminently possible that forms of words can be created, and once they're created, if the people that are involved in making decisions are acting in goodwill, then there is no need for them to get upset or feel insulted by the terminology that's used. And we can then get on with looking at the eugenic principles and implementing eugenic principles and generation by generation in that way, improving the stock of our people.
You know, do it by generation, rather than doing it immediately and preventing somebody from reproducing at all. As you pointed out before, you would just need to reduce the amount. So instead of producing two, they produce one each time. That sort of thing. You could work it out, and you could just gradually do it over the generations. The society was never very large, but it was very vocal. And its propaganda both reflected and promoted views that were held throughout the upper echelons of society, including government and other institutions. It included prominent scientists and medical professionals, alongside the politicians, social reformers, educationalists, leading members of the Church of England, and society figures who were among the most actively involved. Despite differences between the aims and individual members of the Eugenics Laboratory and the Eugenics Society, the journal The Eugenics Review was published under their joint auspices and became a principal vehicle for promoting eugenics ideas to the public. So much as they would try to say today, oh, this was just something that the Nazis were doing, I mean, this is something that everybody that was of a certain intelligence thought was a good idea. That's why it's saying here, through the upper echelons of society. So you've got people in government, you've got teachers, you've got politicians, leading members of the church, leading members of society, all thought that this was a good idea. Why would you not want to improve the chances of the next generation? Why would you not want to improve their physique or improve their intelligence? And why would you not want to export this to all the other people groups around the world? What, you know, you could say to the people in Africa, or, you know, what you could improve your next generation with their physique and improve their intelligence just through selective breeding practices. And everybody would understand it because this is, you know, this is what our farmers do. You know, they have selective breeding practices. They want certain qualities in their cows. They want certain qualities in their sheep. So they breed them for those qualities. And it's just basically doing the same thing, but with humans. So this was just seen as a sensible thing to do. And it was across right wing, left wing. You know, it wasn't a particularly political idea. I guess nowadays you would say that it's probably right wing. Because you're saying that it's the state having an influence on people's lives, on their breeding practices. But at the time, it wasn't really seen as socialist. It wasn't really seen as right wing or left wing. It was just sensible policies, I think. It's interesting that it was right the way across society, but mainly the upper classes. Any comments on that, Max?
Well, I think that there existed a... a cohort of people during the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s, who were all thinking along similar lines, and who had gradually been introduced to the ideas of eugenics as a result of the education that they'd received and as a result of the upbringing that they received. And so you had, you know, within families, you'd have had Charles Darwin and Sir Francis Galton, and there were several other members of their family, cousins who were people of superior intelligence. And there were opportunities for people to go out to the various parts of the empire at the time and to pursue whatever whatever motivated them, and those people who went out and who achieved great things, the sort of people who are on the list of greatest Britons that we've spoken about in the past as well. You know, those people would have had the potential to show themselves as outstanding people of their generation, outstanding people of the cohort that they represented, and it was just natural, I think, because we had a wholesome and healthy outlook as far as life was concerned. We didn't expect everything to be fair. Because life isn't fair. Life very often is unfair. And as far as eugenics is concerned, you know, some people are born with absolutely splendid physiques. Other people are born with the most beautiful facial features. Some people are born with the most wonderful voices. Some people are born with the most wonderful intellects. But life isn't fair, and that some people are born without those things. And some people are born not just with average qualities in those areas, but are born with less desirable qualities. And you know, life isn't fair in that way. And we have to realise that because life isn't fair, and the roll of the dice as far as your genetic inheritance is concerned doesn't produce fair results, somebody has to. As sensible people, we need to find some way of controlling the roll of the dice and of making sure that the dice always rolls in our favour in the future. And once we start to control the roll of the dice, then all sorts of benefits will come to mankind.
Yeah, benefits for the next generation. That was the driving force. Was doing things for the people that are to come after us. And I think also at this time, this principle of nature, of the survival of the fittest, this had been identified through the theory of evolution, and this was then being applied to things, and people realized, well, yes, that is true, it's the survival of the fittest. So you want the fittest people to reproduce, and it is going to be the fittest people that reproduced, all things being equal. But because we have technological advancements and we have medicine and things like that, we end up with people artificially living to an age when they can reproduce, whereas without medicine, without technology, they would never have got that old in the past, and they would have passed away before getting to an age where they could actually breed. So the actual principle of survival of the fittest, this natural principle, was already being interfered with by technology and by medicine. So you needed to compensate for that. And these eugenics ideas, I think, were ways to compensate for that and ways to encourage those who were the fittest to reproduce the most, and those who were the least fit to reproduce the least. Well, the society.
One of the things I very often refer to, if I don't mind me breaking in there, is the fact that if you study the remains of ancient humans, what you find is that the first anatomically modern humans, the people that are generally regarded as being Homo sapiens sapiens, very often described as the Cro-Magnon peoples of that existed in Europe at the time, these people had brains that were something like 10% greater than the average brain size across the world at the moment, which means that one of the unfortunate and unforeseen consequences of civilization is that civilization allows more people to survive and doesn't cull out the less able amongst us, our population, in the way that it used to during the Ice Age. During the Ice Age, people had to have a certain degree of resourcefulness, a certain degree of resilience, a certain degree of energy and hardness in order to survive in the very harsh climate. And those people who didn't have those things didn't survive. Now, I'm not suggesting we should go around and start culling people who we don't regard as magnificent specimens. What I'm saying is that we need to encourage the people who have retained the qualities that enabled our ancestors to survive the Ice Age. We need to encourage those people to have a larger proportion of the children, so that the qualities that they have and that our ancestors had 25 or 30,000 years ago can be multiplied for the benefit of future generations.
We want to have the best quality in the highest quantity. Well, the society organized the first International Eugenics Congress in 1912 at the University of London, which is now Imperial College, in South Kensington, to encourage the international dissemination of eugenicist thinking. Attendance at the Congress illustrates how such thinking crossed the arts and sciences and was embraced by both conservative and progressive thinkers. By this time, Galton had been succeeded as president of the society by Major Leonard Darwin, former Liberal Unionist MP, a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, and the son of Charles Darwin. The vice presidents included literary hostess and patron of the arts, Lady Ottoline Morell, and the writer and sexologist Henry Havelock Ellis. The British vice presidents of the Congress included Liberal politicians Lord Avebury, the Home Secretary Reginald McKenna, the chemist Sir William Ramsay, and the presidents of the Royal Society, the Royal College of Surgeons, and other leading medical and legal institutions. The welcome address was given by the Lord Mayor of London and the former Conservative Prime Minister Arthur Balfour. The American Ambassador, the Duchess of Marlborough, and founding Eugenics Education Society member Lady Emily Lutyens hosted Congress parties at their London residences. Winston Churchill supported the British Eugenics Society and was an honorary vice president for the organization. And Churchill believed that eugenics could solve race deterioration and reduce crime and poverty. So we can really see there that it was including everybody. People from the arts, scientists, people from medicine, politicians, right-wing politicians, left-wing politicians, former prime ministers. I mean, everybody supported this, as Winston Churchill points out. It was hoped that it was going to reduce crime and reduce poverty, because I think we pointed this out before as well. You could see that crime seemed to pass down in families, poverty seemed to be passed down in families, but then you've got the issue of how much of that is nature, how much of that is nurture, how much of that is just the situation that people are in. They're in a situation of poverty, and therefore the children are also going to be in a situation of poverty, and because of that, they may not get the education that they would have had if they weren't within poverty. and if it hadn't been for that, maybe they would have, not been so unable to take care of themselves once they became adults. So there are all these different things, parts of society that they were seeking to improve. And I think back then they had a much greater understanding of inheritance and, how much of what makes you up is actually inherited from your parents and from your family. And I think today we have this false idea of the blank slate, that everybody is just created exactly the same. And it all depends on what the environment imprints onto that slate is how somebody becomes. But that just flies in the face of reality. We all turn in, if you're a man, we all turn into our father most of the time by the time that we get to 40. And they've discovered now, I think it's about 80% nature and 20% nurture. So while you're at school, I mean, that can have a big influence on you. But after you've left school, you become an adult and you go to work, there is far more of an influence in your character that actually comes from your parents and from your family rather than what you were taught at school. Because I guess you move away from school and, it has less and less of an influence on you. And what was naturally within you has more and more of an influence on you. What do you think of all these people that were involved in this, Max? Any thoughts?
Well, I think that, one of the things that's very interesting, and it would be useful to try and catalogue people who were part of the cohort that we're discussing, of people that lived during the late 1800s, early 1900s, who were people of exceptional ability and who actually, despite lowly origins, did actually go on to achieve great things. I'm sure that there's going to be there are going to be a lot of people really that we could include in that category, and this is one of the things that the whole environment that this cohort of people lived in was an environment, first of all, where although it wasn't quite as hostile an environment as existed during the Ice Age, it was a relatively hostile environment for people that didn't have money, because up until the beginning of the 20th century, that there was no welfare state. There was no education for all. There was no national health service for all, and so people had to have a certain amount of intelligence, so that if they contracted an infection because they'd cut their hand or something of that sort, then they would know how to put that right using whatever medicine in inverted commas was available to them, or they would know somebody else in their local community who would have the experience and know what to do with that. Even though people may not have received training in a particular area, they could through self-teaching and self-study, they could develop ideas that are very that are very useful and very profitable, and from the point of view of industry and science, able to make a massive contribution to the rest of society. And if you look at, one of the people that we spoke about just a short while ago, Flinders Petrie, who is now regarded as the founder of modern day archaeology. He existed at a time when archaeology didn't exist, there were no principles or techniques of archaeology. What happened is that people sometimes stumbled over an artifact that had otherwise been left buried for centuries, and they just picked up and thought, "Oh, that's nice, I'll take it to a museum," and the museum would catalogue it, but then not know anything else about it. But Flinders Petrie didn't need somebody to teach him the basic principles of archaeology. He was so interested in the subject, he devised the basic principles himself and then went on to teach other people so that they could become successful archaeologists as well. It's that sort of thing that was so prominent in that cohort of people, because they didn't have a they weren't reliant upon the state to spoon feed them life. They were able to go out and grasp life with both hands and be successful, whatever their origins.
Yeah, I think Petri, he already had inherited from his family the ability to do things like that, and that was his inheritance. That was why he was able to develop these ways, because he had this high IQ. I think he was a polymath as well. But we all have this liking for the myth of the plucky underdog who from nothing manages to get somewhere. And I don't know how much of that is from Hollywood, you know, which introduces this stereotype or archetype of the plucky underdog that rises from nothing and becomes a great hero and gets the girl and all the rest of it. And that sort of tells us that environment is responsible for far more than is actually the fact. Where, as the Flinders Petrie example there gives us, Flinders Petrie came from an illustrious family. He had very intelligent parents, very capable parents. That's why he was capable in the first place, and that's why he was able to do all these great things. And what eugenics is about is giving people that ability, so that they have that ability there to make the most out of what they've got, I guess. Well, some of those who attended the Congress in 1912 do not appear to have participated in the society after that date, and not all participants accepted the society line without question, and some even argued against it. In his paper on the sterilization of the unfit, the scientist and anarchist Prince Peter Kropotkin asked who it was proposed to sterilize as the unfit. The workers or the idlers, the rich or the poor, the poor women who suckled their children, or the women of the upper classes who refused maternity. And this is the point that they try to make, that people are against eugenics. They say that it all depends on what the leading people of the day decide is fit or unfit. But, I mean, that may be true to an extent. But surely we can all agree on the fact that to have chromosomal problems or genetic diseases, that's not going to be of benefit to ensure that the next generation also inherit them. I mean, you, what are you saying here? Is it going to be the rich or the poor? Well, clearly the rich are rich because they have abilities that the poor don't have. And of course, somebody who is an anarchist will say, well, no, they're just rich because they are nasty people and they've chosen to oppress the poor. So I guess you've got two different ways of looking at this. And I find it interesting. This is a prince. They say he's a scientist and an anarchist, Prince Peter Kropotkin. So I guess he must be wealthy enough to afford to be an anarchist. What do you make of what he's saying here, Max, and this idea that eugenics is just based upon what the ruling regime decide is fit or unfit?
I think that that there is some truth in what he says, but what we need to do is to make sure that the ruling elite start off with the right ideas. And I mentioned to you, I think it was within the last sort of couple of weeks or so, the idea of having a system of pastoral care that could be take the place of religion. It could take the place of the Church of England, effectively. And what I mentioned was that in times gone by, people who were ministers of the church would tend to take a much more paternalistic view of their flock, in inverted commas, and would strive to make sure that if there were useful people within their flock, that those useful people were usefully employed and that they didn't waste their lives, etc. But you know, that kind of an approach could well, I say it could replace the Church of England. It could actually, the Church of England could evolve into this particular role. But if the Church of England were to embrace eugenics and were to embrace paternalism and the provision of pastoral care, then we could have a system set up where there are ministers who would become familiar with every member of their flock and whose job it would be to make sure that the people that form their flock are made the optimum use of in terms of building our society and driving our nation forward. And so instead of it being just people who have become wealthy under the old corrupt system deciding who are the people that have got the preferred characteristics, or instead of it being the people who haven't achieved anything under the old corrupt system, who would be responsible for choosing the characteristics that we wanted to promote. It would be people who for whom the role of making that choice was a vocation, and a vocation that didn't bestow upon them great wealth, a vocation that they would enter into with the mission of improving the stock and improving the people who are amongst within their flock as much as possible, generation by generation, through the application of eugenic principles. And in that way, it would be a decision, and it would be a regime that wouldn't be dependent upon, that wouldn't be devised by the very wealthy, and wouldn't be devised by the very poor. It would be devised by a body of people who would be disinterested in personal advancement, but whose contribution to our people and whose contribution to posterity would be that they would advance the people under their tutelage or under their care to a far greater extent than otherwise would be possible.
Yeah, leaders in spiritual matters would seem to be just the right sort of people to be actually making up that group. And there were members of the Church of England that were involved. They took quite a prominent role. It's not like the church was hiding away from this. They did take a prominent role in the Eugenic Society. Well, I think we should probably leave that here for today, Max, unless you got anything else you want to say on eugenics?
No, I think we've covered enough for today. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.